Hey everyone, welcome to another edition of the Front Stretch Podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Albino. Great weekend of racing last week in two of the biggest races of the year, that being the Indy 500 and the Coca-Cola 600. Neff was at the Coca-Cola 600, so he'll talk to us about that. Also, the Xfinity race was pretty wild, and we got Jeffrey Earnhardt calling into the show to break down his career-best third-place effort. But before we get started, make sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the Front Stretch Podcast on iTunes and leave us a review. Those ratings and reviews help us out tremendously. Now let's talk a fun weekend of racing, and I think we're kind of spoiled by it, honestly, with Neff. All right, Neff, I feel like we got a lot to talk about. Busy Memorial Day weekend of racing. Obviously, we had the Xfinity race on Saturday, which was incredible. And then on Sunday, we had Monaco, which was, we were talking offline, but then we had the Indy 500, which was great, fantastic, thrilling ending. And then the Coke 600 was great throughout. So I don't know where to start. I guess we'll start with the 600. Great race, Neff.
I was very pleasantly surprised. You never know what to expect when we go to Charlotte. And it's been years since they repaved it. And it's been an ongoing battle to try to get that track to age a little bit and have tires start making a difference. And they finally did. And the package seemed to work great. There were comers, there were goers. It was still difficult to pass the leader, but all in all, I mean, I thought it was a fantastic race. There were strategies involved, different people on different agendas. Thankfully, the weather was really great. And the crowd was fantastic, too. I mean, that's the best crowd I've seen at 600 in a long time.
Yeah, and you mentioned all those factors, and it led to a great race. There's 30 lead changes. Now, some of them, of course, were through green flag pit stops, but a lot of them weren't. You know, you had Martin Truex Jr., who won the race. We should probably mention that. He hit the wall. He almost knocked the wall down there at the end of the first stage, and then he comes back. And he said that, you know, if he hadn't hit the wall, they'd be whipping him. He comes back and wins the race, Neff. So, I don't know. I mean, had he not have hit the wall, we might have been in for a boring race because he hit the wall from the lead early on.
I don't know if we would have or not. I was talking to Trent Owens after the race on Chris Buescher's car, who had a great finish as well. Mm-hmm. And he kind of was joking, but I believe he was kind of serious, too, that after they hit the wall, their car was faster. And I'm not so sure that Truex hitting the wall didn't actually make them a little bit faster than they were before they hit the wall.
That could be the case. I mean, you look at, there was a ton of tire problems, and, you know, mostly with Toyota. So you got to think it's camber or something up in the front end of the car because they're all right front. And if you heard over the radio, which you were at the race, I don't know if you heard the 19 radio, but Cole Pern told the spotter that he knows some information that he can't tell him right now because everyone would hear it. And it'd be public knowledge. So it was very odd to see all those tire problems. But then you had the two JDG cars also have tire problems. But for Truex, man, this is his third win in the past five races. That's the most amount of wins he's had in a five race span in his career. This 19 team, you know, we start 2 months ago, we were like, oh, what's going on with them? And they were transitioning. And now, man, they're on fire.
Yeah, they have transitioned. I do believe it's the case. I mean, you know, you're switching not only organizations, but towns and time zones and everything coming out here to Huntersville from Denver. And you're acclimating to new people. I mean, it's just a different means of working. And things are different when you're in a new organization rather than being the organization. So I'm sure there was an acclimation process that had to go on before they got totally in sync, and they definitely are in sync now. And I mean, and we've seen all year long that Gibbs and Penske are the two strongest teams. Gibbs, I think, is once again proven that they are the team to beat. It's got to be some additional pressure landing on the shoulders of Eric Jones, because everybody else on that team is looking pretty good. Outside of Denny Hamlin, who has flashes of brilliance and flashes of failure. You had to help me out on it. At the end of the race there, I was standing on pit lane, so I did not see what happened to Hamlin. I just saw him dragging down the front stretch wall at the end. So I don't know if he just popped a tire or if he did something with somebody else there. But yeah, Gibbs is rolling, and Truex, I mean, in the past, we've seen Truex take a little while to get going. So they're definitely going to be a strong contender for another title. And in all honesty, if it hadn't been for a weird set of circumstances last year, they may have been going for three in a row.
Right. I think Hamlin got spun in there at the end because he hit that wall, you know, head on pretty hard. So that's the only thing that I can come up with. I don't know. Fox didn't really give a great angle of it, but I can't remember off the top of my head anyway. But you bring up the Gibbs and Penske aspect, and we're halfway through the regular season now. We've done, 14 podcasts? This is the 15th, including the Clash. We've talked a lot about Penske and Gibbs. It's kind of getting repetitive, but for good reason, because they've won 12 of the 13 races. I mean, Hendrick's obviously stepping up. All four of their cars finished inside the top 10 the other night now for the first time since the Spring Texas race in 2016. That was quite a stat that I found, and I found it hard to believe because, yes, they've been struggling for so long, but they've always had good drivers. Is Hendrick kind of the team that can challenge them right now? Because it seems like, to me, Stewart Haas has fast cars that can qualify well. They can run fast for one lap, but then even like Harvick the other night, he was good early on in a run, and then he'd fall off throughout.
Yeah, Harvick looked irritated at the end of the night. And most of the interviews seemed really terse, so I don't know that he was thrilled with his evening. Honestly, I think Richard Childress can give him a run. I mean, they've been really fast in qualifying, and it's just a matter of making it to the end for those guys. Hemric has been really quick and has shown when he qualifies near the front, he can stay near the front, but he ends up having things happen, and it happened again on Sunday night. So I feel like Childress has got the potential there. Obviously, Hendrick is the 800-pound gorilla, and you would think that eventually they're going to get there, and that it seems like they're creeping up on it. They do have the only win that Penske and JGR have a claim this year. So it would seem obvious that Hendrick should be the one to give those guys a go for it. But I've been saying all along on these podcasts that I thought Charlotte – would kind of be the bellwether. And once we got to Charlotte, we would see if anybody else was going to be giving them a challenge. And it's still, right now, Gibbs and Penske and everybody else. So they're closing in on them, but at this point, you've still got the two powerhouses and everybody else.
Yeah, and Gibbs has won 8 races through the first 13. How many do you think they'll end up with this year?
That's such a hard thing to say, but I mean, in the grand scheme of things, there's no reason they couldn't stay on this pace and probably end up winning another 12 or 13 races.
Yeah, I was going to say at least half the schedule, which is obviously 18. But they're on a roll right now, and it's hard to stop them because, I mean, no one has yet, really. So, Neff, I was also impressed with Joey Logano on Sunday night because for the first, I don't know, four-fifths of that race, the 22 is out to lunch. At times running from outside the top 20, in the first run, he fell from 7th to 20th in the first, 20 laps or so. He comes back to finish 2nd and nearly knocked Truex out of the way for the win on the last restart. Obviously, he's the defending champ, but that's a championship performance right there.
Yeah, and it was kind of interesting watching Penske because they had the whole spectrum covered. Keselowski was up front early, and then as we transitioned to the dark, it seemed like they were struggling. Blaney was pretty much up front most of the night, and then Logano was struggling early in there at the end. So they kind of had the whole spectrum covered. But near the end there, I thought Blaney and Logano were going to gang up on him and really, run away with the thing. But Truex just wasn't letting them. And Logano, I mean, and then it's cliche to say it, but yeah, that's a championship type performance that they sat there and just kept working on it and working on it and working on it and finally got it dialed in when it meant the most.
For sure. And you brought up Blaney and you brought up Eric Jones earlier. It just seems, obviously the other 5 of the 7 combined drivers between Penske and Gibbs have won this year. But it just seems to compound it. Blaney's running well. He hasn't run well for much of the past month, but he was running well in the 600 all night. Then he has a loose wheel with 10 laps to go as to pit. Luckily, he gets a caution, so he didn't go a lap down, but finishes 13th when he probably should have finished 3rd or 4th. And then Eric Jones brings out the first caution, 20 laps in or so, and blows a right front tire. And out of the other two Gibbs cars that blew, and I guess DiBenedetto, he got retired from the race. But with Hamlin and Truex, they continued on and still had fast cars. So it just seems like the two drivers that haven't won yet out of those stables, it just something happens every week. And ultimately, they have fast cars, but they can't win.
Absolutely. It all comes down to, you know, putting the whole thing together. And we've talked about it. It's hard to win these races. And I feel that way about Hemric, too. I think it's one of these things that just, these are longer races than they're used to running. And getting the whole package to get together for the whole time takes a while. I know Blaney's won a couple races, and so he's done it. But it's just sometimes it takes repetition to finally get that system down where you're consistent at it. And I don't know why they've had issues pop up, but it seems like it's been pretty consistent with them. So it's not like it's a fluke thing. And it's a matter of they just got to kind of study tape and focus more. And, you know, I mean, it's hard. It's easy to sit and say, yeah, you got to focus more. I mean, these guys are on the edge all through these races. People complain that these cars are easy to drive, and they're not. And they're pretty much all out all the time. So focusing is a given. But it's at the same time, that little bit, you slip up one split second can cost you everything.
Sure. And I want to talk about three more drivers kind of in detail here. And I want to start off with Ricky Stenhouse Jr., Neff. He picked up his first career top five on an intermediate track the other night at Charlotte, which was kind of blew my mind because this is, what, his seventh full-time year. And yes, Roush has been out to lunch for a lot of those years, but I mean, he's still a good driver and, you know, productive. And like at Kansas, was leading late in the race, ultimately finished 11th. But good run for that 17 team. They definitely needed it. Like I said, they finished 11th at Kansas, but before that, they're on a streak of like six straight races of outside the top 15. So, were you impressed by Stenhouse? Because I was, and that, you know, that stemmed from a early race incident with Kyle Busch when the 17 spun off the front bumper of the 18.
Yeah, I was going to say there was a lot going on with the 17, and it wasn't a plate track, which usually it's plate tracks where he gets a lot of attention. But he was mixing it up with Busch there, and Busch didn't like the way he was treated and kind of gave him a little shot. And it ended up in him spinning. Luckily, went through the artificial turf, so it didn't destroy the car, and that's always a good thing. But it's been a long struggle, and you're right. For most of the time that Stenhouse has been at Roush, they have been struggling. And I don't know that you don't put all of it on Stenhouse, but some of it's got to go on Stenhouse's shoulder because he's the guy. I mean, Biffle's gone, Kenseth's gone, Bain's gone. All, you know, he's the only one that's been a constant through this whole time. So at least part of that blame or part of the reasoning has to go on his shoulders too. So it's good to see them have that run. Let's see if they can capitalize on it and do it more times. And that it wasn't just a fluke this one time. But Stenhouse, I've always thought, has had the ability. I mean, the guy's a champion in the Busch series. So I don't think he's a back of the pack runner by any stretch if he's in good equipment. And it's just been a matter of getting the equipment to match his talent. We'll see if this run is a signal that Roush is figuring some stuff out. Because Newman, I looked up at the pylon getting ready for the last set of pit stops after that late race caution, and Newman was in fourth. So I don't know if it's coincidence or not, but having Newman there might be helping Roush turn the corner as well.
Yeah, I think it definitely has. In Stenhouse's whole, I wouldn't call it an issue, but kind of, I guess you could call it an issue. His whole career, dating back to Xfinity, even ARCA, he's always gotten too much out of the car. He steps over the boundary and it gets him in trouble. I mean, it got him in trouble in Xfinity back in, what, 2010 or so when he was running?
And then, he got parked for a while.
Yeah, he got parked, and then, you know, he comes out, wins the championship the following year, following 2 years. So, I mean, that's a decade ago now. 2010 is when I think it was the first year he started in Xfinity. But that, like I said, that was his first top five on a 1.5-mile track, which is mind-blowing to me. And also his first top five of the year, Roush's first top five of the year as a whole. But they've shown speed. Like you said, Newman was running good the other night, and then he took two tires at the end and ultimately fell to, I think, 14th. But they're running better. I think Newman's definitely translated well over there with his engineering background. But I guess we'll have to see going forward. Now, if someone else will have to watch going forward, and he's impressed the hell out of me all year long, honestly, and you mentioned his crew chief earlier, Trent Owens, but that's Chris Buescher. Back-to-back top tens for the first time in his Cup career. Blew a tire early on, came back, finished sixth, like you said. Owens said that he might have thought the car was even faster after the blown tire and making contact with the wall. We tout Buescher a lot on this podcast, but we're big fans of him inside the car because he gets the most out of it as well, and he's just a hardcore racer. What's your take on Buescher at Charlotte?
Yeah, I mean, you gotta love the fact that they like to wear that banner of the little team that could. You know, they're definitely smaller budget than some of the big guys, and every now and then they have flashes of brilliance. I feel bad for Priest. He started out at Daytona missing everything that could have caught him up, and he just kind of seemed to have the vision to be able to avoid things, and now it seems like it's catching up to him, and everything that can catch him out and cause him problems is. And they've had some torn up race cars of late. So hoping that he's able to bring it around. But yeah, Buescher has always been one of those guys. I think he's been one of the most underrated drivers in the sport. I think he, as you said, he gets the most out of the car all the time. And I feel like if they get everything lined up, they could catch lightning in a bottle and win a race again. And just the JTG team in general, I feel like, is continuing to get better and better. And they continue to figure out more and more speed and more ways to finish races better. And, you know, it's a process in this business for an organization to start consistently winning races and get up and contend for it. You know, and they may be that next team that crosses over from second-tier team to first-tier team and really start competing for some wins. And it wouldn't surprise me if Buescher ends up being that guy that gets a couple, three wins in a season for that organization.
For sure, yeah. And I'm looking at the championship standings right now, and about 13th to 21st is separated by 50 points. Buescher sits 22nd, and he's 55 points off the cutoff. And if you look at the way he's run, I mean, theoretically, he's outrun Kyle Larson in a lot of races this year. He's outrun Austin Dillon in a lot of races this year. You look at Bristol and Richmond, he finished 22nd in both races, but probably should have finished top 10, definitely at Bristol. He probably should have finished top 5, honestly, but had a cut tire late. And at Richmond, he just the car fell off even though, you know, throughout the race, even though he finished top 10 in the opening two stages. I can see this 37 team going on a run here and getting in the playoffs. Like, you look at some of these guys in front of him, Larson, Jones, Stenhouse, Dillon, even Menard. I mean, they've had some bad luck this year, and sure, Buescher has too. That's why he's behind him in points. But could you see him making the playoffs? Because I could see him making up that 55 points.
Yeah, Buescher's one of those guys that just, if they go on a run where they don't have bad luck and don't shoot themselves in the foot. He's had two or three races this year where they were running well, and then a loose tire late in the going cost them a good finish. Or a loose tire in the middle of the race got them that lap or so down that it took them forever to make up from. And if they can just put consistent runs together and finish without damage on the car, I don't see any reason they can't finish, you know, top 15, top 12 on a regular basis. And that's what it takes to make it into the playoffs. So absolutely, if they continue to climb this ladder and check off boxes over and over again, it will not be surprising at all to see them point their way in while some of the big guns have a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, for sure. And in that mix also is William Byron. And he had a good run in Charlotte, leading 31 laps, sitting from the pole. But Neff, I feel like we got to talk about our boy Corey LaJoy. Because he was wheeling it for Go Fast.
Absolutely.
He was wheeling it for Go Fast. Finished 12th in the Coke 600. That's pretty stout for that team. I know Prost Race, he said that's like three wins for the 32 team. Because you got to look at, you know, we're talking about the budget some of these teams work on. And theirs is a fraction of some of the teams they even beat. Like Newman, that's even a fraction of Roush's budget. Suarez, real fraction of Stuart Haas's budget. Good run for him. You know, it's two top 15s in the past four races now. He had an 11th at Talladega. It's his best run on a non-super speedway race ever in the Cup Series. So, I mean, that's big for Archie's team, for the 32 team.
No doubt. And, you know, it's one of those things that I consider Shua a very close personal friend. And in talking with him these years that he's been in Cup, and he's a realist, and he knows what he's working with and what he's doing, and like anybody else, trying to climb up that ladder. And for them to just be consistent and be able to not, like we've talked about, shoot themselves in the foot. Sure, he got lucky early on that we had so many cautions in the first stage that kind of kept him on the lead lap, kept him from getting lapped. And then at the end of the second stage, he was right there. It got lapped like three laps from the end, so he got the lucky dog. He did get a lucky dog early in the first stage, too, so he had a couple of them. But at that point, he maximized his opportunity of being on the lead lap. And there were a ton of cars on the lead lap at the midway point, which was kind of interesting in the 600, because that usually doesn't happen. And he just kept his nose clean, did what he was able to do, and then near the end of the race, a lot of the bigger guys started having a lot of problems. And it wasn't just him either. I want to give a shout-out to Parker Kligerman, too. I know he didn't get the finish that he wanted because right at the end they had a problem with the car, but he was running with that group that finished like 8th to 15th all night long and is another one of those teams that doesn't have the funding. And I talked to him post-race, and he was kind of bitter, so he wasn't real talkative. But for whatever reason, their rounds and their left front spring backed out. And it's just not something that normally happens in a car. And so it caused his car handling to really go away at the end of the race. But, yeah, these guys in these underfunded teams, it comes down to execution. And as you said, Corey feels like it's three wins in a row, and that's what it took to win a race for the higher level teams. A clean race, no mistakes on pit lane, no contact with anybody, keep your fenders clean, and just run a full race. And that's, in the end, that's what Corey did. And for them, it's a 12th place finish, but for them, that's about as good as you're going to get. So that's why he's treating it like a win.
For sure. And I would say he ran top 22, 23 all night long, really. So, I mean, overall, yes, it was his best finish outside of a super speedway ever, but it was probably the best he's ever run throughout a whole race ever, honestly, even if you look at the super speedway races, because of the funding that he's had and the equipment he's been in, and unfortunately, obviously, we all know, you're only as good as your equipment in NASCAR these days, but, you know, we both believe in Corey. We know what he can do behind the wheel. We've seen what he can do behind the wheel. A few years back, he was beating Blaney and Chase, Bubba, Suarez at the K&N level. There's no reason why if he got in the right equipment now that he couldn't do the same thing right now at the Cup level. But then, now if you look at teams like, you know, the little teams came to play in the Coke 600. You look at Front Row Motorsports, David Reagan was running the top 10 for most of the race. That was incredible for that team.
Yeah, Front Row was in contention. They were on the front. They were on the front row for the final restart of the race, and they were definitely in the mix. And it was surprising. Should say surprising because that's not fair to them. But to have them be up in that mix most of the night was different. And yeah, give them a big thumbs up. They had a really strong run with all three of their cars. Honestly.
Yeah. Tiff tied a career best 20th place finish, also getting that feat at Phoenix earlier this year. Neff, really good Coke 600, in my opinion, probably the best one in at least a decade, at least. And like you said, you were there. The crowd turned out well. I mean, this is what Charlotte needs. We need, you know, people like Denny Hamlin last week or whenever he was asked about it said, oh, there's no significance in the Coke 600. It could be the Coke 300, and it's the same thing. It's a race.
No.
And yeah, I mean, I respect Denny Hamlin a lot, but I think that's the furthest thing from the truth. If you were to go, and you hear people talking about this all weekend, if the Coke 600 were even to lose 100 miles, I mean, that's what stands this race out from every other race. You know, a lot of races we talk about shortening the mileage, and you know, maybe that's so. Maybe we can do that. But the Coke 600 has to stay. It's an attrition race. It has to stay.
Yep.
It has to be a marathon.
And talk about it all you want. Everybody's like, you know, the cars don't fail anymore, which is true. You don't get mechanical failures like you used to. But drivers do. And the bottom line is this race, that last 100 miles separates the men from the boys. And you get guys falling out of the seat, whether they're going to admit it or not. But there are guys that fall out of the seat near the end of that race, and it costs them positions. And it's because of the length of the race, because of the transition from day to night, because of the fact that it's at the end of the long weekend where guys get up to watch Monaco and they watch Indy, and there's a lot of activity around the race to where it takes a toll on everybody. And crew members make mistakes in that last 100 miles. The drivers make mistakes. There's certain traditions and histories in this sport that need to stay. And Daytona needs to be 500 miles. Charlotte needs to be 600 miles. The Southern 500 needs to be 500. Although, in honesty, I still wish they would switch that and make that a day race and really cook those guys. I mean, you had 117 degrees in Bubba's car this weekend. You run them on Labor Day at Darlington, we'll get up into 130s inside those cars. And it'll be, again, a test of man and machine. And that's, I know it's rough on fans to go to an all-day race like that in the heat of the summer. But in all honesty, if you talk to people that have been around it for a long time, yeah, it's hot, but that's part of what made it cool.
Right.
And there's no reason other than just get, I'm at a loss for a word, but just catering to the demands of the partial or part-time fans that complain about the length of the races in general. But there need to be exceptions, and the 600 must always be an exception and always needs to be run at that distance at Charlotte.
Yeah, I mean, the race, I mean, it was long, but we knew that. It was 4 hours and 50 minutes long. That is a long time for anyone. But you got to remember, like, the drivers are the ones that are really feeling it. Like you said, you know, it was hot in Charlotte this past weekend, especially for the Xfinity race. But the 600s, it's got to say the 600. It's a crown jewel event. Like you said, the 600, the Daytona 500, the Southern 500. The Southern 500, I mean, that's going to historically be a long race because tire fall off there is insane throughout a run. So it's always going to be a long race, and it's 500 miles long. So I don't know. Leave these races alone, honestly. Like, we're at the point now where, you know, we're shortening races and doing double headers, which we're a fan of next year at Pocono. But I don't know. Just leave them alone for now. And obviously, I'm talking distance-wise, schedule-wise, that's going to come to a change in 2021, obviously.
Yep.
Neff, do you want to talk about Indy, or do you want to tease the bag and we'll go to Charlotte with the Xfinity race?
Let's go with Xfinity first.
Got it. Yeah, because I think we're going to spend some time on Indy. Neff, Tyler Reddick, he's on a roll right now. He's got eight straight top fives. He started inside the top five, 8 races as well. He's got 9 top fives for the year. Man, he's the defending champ, Neff, but this guy's on a roll. Led 110 laps at Charlotte, which is the most he's ever led in a race in NASCAR, at least at the Xfinity level. And you had guys like Christopher Bell and Brandon Jones who, you know, just like their teammates at the Cup level, also had right front failures. So, I mean, that must be a Joe Gibbs problem.
Joe Gibbs or just Toyota in general. I think it was something of the way they're doing their front end geometry that was putting excessive wear on the right front, and the tire that they brought to Charlotte apparently didn't like it. And I guess that's another one of those that your practice time at these races is tough, and you have to manage it, and you have an agenda of things you want to go through. And full fuel runs are not necessarily on anybody's agenda these days. But it may be one of those things that teams are going to start doing again just to be positive that the tires are going to last. Because, you know, most of the time, and it's a frustration for me because I like tires that fail. I honestly think the mentality should be if you run at 100% throttle, you can only run three quarters of a fuel run before your tires will blow.
Right.
And that you should have to back off in order to make them last. The problem with that is in the Goodyear world, if they have tires failing, it's a PR nightmare for them. And they've got to come out and defend them, and it just turns into a mess. If the key would be NASCAR needs to get out publicly in front of it and say, this is what we want. We want tires that you cannot go full hammer down for a full fuel run. We want tires that will wear out and will fail if you push them too hard. And it is our mandate to Goodyear. So when tires start failing, know that it's on the team and not on Goodyear. But at this point, they haven't done that. So Goodyear brings tires which are safe and last and are designed to be abused. And every now and then that doesn't come through. And you end up having an instance like we did this past weekend. But for the most part, they bring indestructible tires, so teams don't worry about tires lasting. And then all of a sudden you get into a race, and whoa, we've got multiple people blowing tires at the three-quarter point of the fuel run. Everybody then has to start worrying about it. So it's if that became the norm, then I think you would have more teams running full fuel runs in practice, and you would catch this before race time. But because of the fact that it's such a rare occurrence, when it does happen, it's going to grab whole organizations because they all use the same mentality in their geometry most of the time.
Yeah, you hit a lot of good points there. And Goodyear's in a kind of a no-win situation because they got to make tires that are durable. And when they don't, you have drivers like Kevin Harvick and Kyle Busch who are always blunt. That say either the tires suck, like Harvick did after, I believe, the Texas race this year when there's really no fall-off. Or when there is fall-off, Kyle Busch might, you know, spin out, which he's done in the past, and I don't know, he crashes and says the tires suck just like Harvick. So they're in a no-win situation. Like you said, if they can only go so far, because like you, I'm in favor of tire fall-off. I think tire management races are the best races. You look at Atlanta over the years, Fontana in recent memory. They've been really good races because of the fall-off. Even the 600, there was some fall-off, and it was a good race, which is good for this new package. But yeah, I mean, as far as Joe Gibbs Racing and Toyota is concerned, yeah, there's got to be something in the front geometry of the car there. Obviously, it seems like they know what it is because in the Cup race, as I mentioned,
from Cole Pern's comments.
As I mentioned, Cole Pern said that he couldn't say what was going on. He knew he had some knowledge, but didn't want to display it to the public, which is understandable. But hey, if you know what's going on, I guess fix it, and then maybe we won't have that problem. But enough. Getting back to Reddick, he's got a 65-point lead in the standings right now, which is obviously more than a full race. Christopher, you know, there's talk of the big three this year in Xfinity, which is true. They've won 7 of the 11 races, Reddick, Bell, and Custer. I don't know why I was drawing a blank there. But Reddick's super consistent this year, which is something he wasn't last year.
Yeah, give him a shout out. I have personal bias in this one because I used to work on his crew chief's late model back when he was a racer. So I know Randy comes from the UNCC school of motorsports, like Matt McCall and a handful of other crew chiefs that are in the sport, and they've cut their teeth at local racing. They've come up through some different organizations at the Cup level. Randy was a crew chief at the Cup level for a while with JTG on the 47 with Allmendinger, and now he's taken a step back to Xfinity, but Childress for a while was the premier Xfinity teams, and then they kind of fell off. And now it seems that they've refocused some energy on that side of things, and they're coming back. And it seems like it's a really good driver crew chief combination between Randy and Tyler, and we're seeing the fruits of that right now. So we'll see if they can run it all season. But for right now, Tyler's giving good feedback. Randy's making good adjustments in the car. And your end result is everybody else is a squirrel trying to find a nut. So they better step it up.
They better find that nut.
They just run away and hide this year.
Yeah, they better find that nut. like Stenhouse, we said earlier, Reddick always gets the most out of his car. But he's really seemed to not slow it down this year. And he's just more consistent. And I think he would even tell you that he's kind of backed it down in terms of going over that edge. Something that maybe Stenhouse or other drivers haven't done yet. But yeah, Reddick's on fire right now, and he's definitely a force to be reckoned with. Neff, a few other drivers had really good runs. Justin Haley got his first top five, third top five for Colleague Racing in its existence, 3.5 years now. Jeb Burton, former podcast guest earlier this year, finished seventh. But Neff, this week's podcast guest is Jeffrey Earnhardt, who finished third. I want to talk a little bit about him right now because, you know, he got in the wall, caused a caution early on in the race, came back, rebounded to finish third, as I mentioned. First top five in his NASCAR career. He's making the most out of this opportunity with Joe Gibbs Racing that he has, and also Extreme Concepts Racing in the two cup races they have this year.
No doubt about it. A huge shout out to them for the wrap that he had on the car.
Yeah.
It was awesome that they memorialized a K-9 officer that had fallen. I thought that was really cool. There's the 18 car is really fast in the right hands, and in the wrong hands, it's just an average car. And I think that to give thumbs up to Jeffrey about it, he is proving that he can be fast. And we've had some other drivers that have gotten in that 18 and finished, you know, 15th to 20th, but the right guys, Ryan Preece gets in that thing, and it's a hot rod. Some of these other guys that get in there, they can run fast. And Jeffrey's proven that he's got the ability to run fast in a good car. And I think it's cool that he has paid his dues over the years. He has definitely broken ranks from the family tradition and gone to Toyota instead of Chevrolet. But he had to do what was best for his career. You know, Chevy wasn't offering him anything, and Toyota did. So you got to go with what's best for your career. And since he's chasing this dream, and they're, you know, they've been giving him this shot both in Cup and in Xfinity this year, I think he's making the most of it. And it'll be really neat if it turns into something full time with a good team. Because I think he's now proven what a lot of us have felt, that he had the abilities, but he just hasn't really been in the equipment to show it off. So it was really cool. And apparently hitting the wall made your car faster this weekend. I won't be surprised next time we go back to Charlotte that everybody gives a little rub, like on the warm-up laps or something, just to make them a little bit quicker, because that seemed to be the answer this weekend.
It does seem to be. But yeah, when it comes to Jeffrey, this just comes to show you what a change in scenery can do, right? Like, he spent all these years for low-budget teams, whether it's even Johnny Davis, you know, JD Motorsports in the Xfinity Series, or at the Cup level with Gaunt Brothers or Premium or whoever, you know. And then he gets this opportunity, which he should be fast in the 18 car. As you said, it's really fast car, probably the fastest car in Xfinity when it's in the right hands, as you said. But, you know, he was talking to me a couple months back, and just the amount of sim time he's getting on the simulator, the Toyota simulator, is leaps and bounds ahead of, you know, more than what he could do at Chevrolet, because he had to beg to get sim time there. So it's definitely transpired out in the race. I wish it could lead to a full-time opportunity, and I know that's the goal next year for him, whether it's with JGR or I know this Extreme Concepts Racing team, they mean business. So And then they got an alliance with Gibbs, so we'll have to see going forward. Like, he was right up in the mix there at Talladega in the Cup race until the last lap when him and Larson got into it, and Larson evidently went into the wall upside down. But that's definitely something to look forward to for Jeffrey and his career. And, yeah, just super good guy, too, just down to earth.
Absolutely. He did an MMA fight, which I thought was kind of cool, just to prove that he could do it. But yeah, he's just a good old boy from North Carolina that loves racing. And when it's all said and done, he's finally getting a shot to prove that he's got the ability, and now he knows it's in his hands. And fortunately, he's taking advantage of it and doing the right things. And like you said, if he does well, hopefully that'll open some more doors and move him on up the Toyota ladder.
All right, now, Freddy, to talk some Indy?
I am.
All right, perfect, because this is the perfect time to do it. Neff, that was an incredible race, I thought, especially the ending. You had Simon Pagenaud dominate the race. So, I mean, you led 116 of 200 laps. When that happens, you're thinking, oh, is the race really that good? And yes, it was. There was a lot of good racing throughout. The ending, though, Neff, was incredible with him and Alexander Rossi, who was driving like a chicken with his head cut off, honestly, the whole race. You know, pumping his fist at Oriel Servia down the front stretch, which is incredible, insane to do at 230 miles per hour. I mean, think of putting your hand out a passenger door at 55 miles per hour and the wind that takes it back. Now do that with an open cockpit at 230. I would not advise it, but be my guest. Regardless, really good ending with Sato right up there, Takuma Sato. But Pagenaud gets the win. You called it last week. You said it was going to be a Team Penske guy, and it was. It's Penske's 18th Indy 500.
Yeah, I was bummed for my boy Carpenter. Carpenter was right up in the top five, really top three most of the day, top five all day, and was just playing it smart. Wasn't pushing it, was saving fuel, had himself in the right position, and then when push came to shove at the end, he just kind of got shuffled out a little bit. But Rossi and Oriel Servia is lucky that it was open wheel, because I got to feel like if they had had fenders on those cars, Servia would have been in the wall on a front stretch, because that was not a cool maneuver at all. But it's funny what adrenaline will do for you, because I'd have probably been... You'll notice he didn't extend his finger. It might have ripped his finger off if he'd have stuck that up, but he had every right to be pissed off. The interesting thing to me was everybody's viewpoint was you couldn't lead and make it to the end with the fuel strategy that everybody had laid out. And yet Pagenaud was getting the fuel mileage that most everybody was getting. I mean, Dixon still had the best, and I think if the late cautions hadn't fallen the way they had, I think Dixon would have out-fueled them. But, I mean, when it all came down to it at the end, Pagenaud had the car all weekend. And, you know, he won the pole, won the Grand Prix earlier, and in the end, I don't know that Penske'd ever admit to it, but there's those people that believe that it was Pagenaud's last year if he didn't get some stuff done this year. And he definitely stepped up this month of May and got it done twice.
Yeah, he swept the month of May at Indy. And in the post-race press conference, Roger Penske straight up said that he has a job for next year. Pagenaud has a job. So he'll be back for Penske next year. But yeah, as you said, like, it was just he dominated a lot of the race, but there was a lot of good battles. Like you said, Carpenter was in the top three a lot of the race. I thought had the race gone green, he might have been in the best position. Possibly Rossi. However, he had the late, you know, the fuel issue with them getting the fuel in it. So I'm thinking, oh, maybe it cost him positions. He ultimately got, you know, fifth on the restart because there was a caution as soon as it happened. That honestly saved him quite a bit of track position. Because that was a 23-second pit stop. It's going to cost you 15 seconds on the field, which, I don't know, probably at least 10 positions. But, yeah, Carpenter fell to sixth. You had Will Power come from the back after a penalty to finish fifth. Newgarden fourth. But Rossi put on a show, and that seems to be the case in the past few Indy 500s, obviously winning the 100th running 3 years ago. But I've talked to a couple people this week just about racing stuff, whether it's our colleagues at Front Stretch or whomever. Rossi reminds me of Kyle Larson. Does he you?
A little. He's
fearless.
He's just one of those dudes that seems to be genetically fast. And whatever course they're on, he always seems to kind of rise to the top a little bit, but at the same time is willing to drive very aggressively to get there when he has to. And I think that kind of endears him to the fans in general. And I think it's got him in position to be a star in a sport for quite some time. It's especially being an American driver, there aren't a lot of American drivers anymore. I mean, we had 14 in the field of 33. So you're less than half the field was American drivers. And it's cool to be able to wrap your arms around a local guy, as it were. He's just got it. You can't really always quantify it, but he definitely has the charisma and the overall excitement that the fans like to gravitate to.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's fearless. You look at, like, the thing on Sunday when he's, got this fist out the window. Someone tweeted to me, a fan of IndyCar, and they said that their friend had taken a ride around with Mario Andretti, and they put their hand up, and they only go, like, 180 compared to 230. I say only, but that's pretty fast. It almost took their, like, arm off, because that's a lot of wind, obviously, coming at you. And like you said, if he had put a finger up, I mean, who knows what would have happened.
Exactly.
But, yeah, he's fearless, man. And I think of, like, the Indy 500 last year when he was making all these moves late on restarts and up against the wall and somehow making it work. Ultimately, he lost out on about $2 million by 0.2 seconds. And that really sucks this year.
Yeah. I want to give a shout-out, too, to Christian Bale and Matt Damon. There was somebody sent out a picture during the race that, like, 40 laps in, they were still in the flag stand.
Oh, wow.
And I forget who it was 3 or 4 years ago, waved the green flag and literally stayed in the flag stand for the first half of the race. And I don't blame them. I mean, there aren't a whole heck of a lot better seats in the place than standing in the flag stand to watch the 500. So I would probably be pretty tempted to stay there myself, but it's kind of cool that guys, they get that opportunity and they take full advantage of it. Cause a lot of folks, I don't know that they appreciate what they get to do when they get to wave that green flag. And those guys definitely took advantage of it and enjoyed it.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of people would die for that opportunity, even if it was just for like a practice. But when you have 33 cars coming at you at 230 miles per hour, that's special. I would definitely stay there as long as I could as well.
No doubt. And I don't know if they do it anymore. They may start doing it again. But I went to qualifying at Talladega years ago. And it was single car qualifying. And during qualifying, they let fans wave the green flag for the qualifying effort.
That's cool.
So there was literally, like, any fan could do it. There was a line of people at the flag stand. And just one person after another got to climb up and wave the green flag for whatever car happened to be when you were climbing up the flag stand. But that was a cool thing. I had never seen that at a racetrack before, and I thought it was really neat. Now that they're getting back into single car qualifying, we may see them start doing that again.
Yeah, it could be the case. Now, if anything else on Indy you want to talk about before I kind of ask you, in my opinion, a tough question?
Indy is Indy. I was there, lucky enough to be there for the 100th running. I grew up in Indy. I missed four races from 63 until 96, and it always has been the greatest race to me. It had its down period after the split, all the way up to the 100th running. And then when we had the 100th running, the place was packed out again. They actually sold the race out, first time in history. And yes, there were still some open seats this time, but not many. And it is fantastic to see Indy getting back to that point that they are as the preeminent race of the whole year.
Yeah, and you can comment on this too if you want. I thought NBC did an incredible job. It was the first year that they had broadcasted the 500. And they brought in a lot of, you know, the people that they have cover the NASCAR races, whether it's Marty Snyder or Kelly Stavis in the pits, Chris Devoda as a host. But then you have people like Dale Jr., who's a big crossover star, obviously. Rutledge Wood, who's entertaining as all hell. I mean, those two together, it's awesome. It's a dynamic duo. And then you had, you know, they brought in big name broadcasters like Mike Tirico, and Lee Diffie did an incredible call on the incredible job on the call of the race. Danica was there on the Peacock pit box with Tirico and Junior the whole race. I thought NBC, and the ratings were up. I thought NBC did a great job.
Yeah, I thought it was decent. I'm biased. I want to see Bob Jenkins calling a 500. I've always thought he did the best job at it, and it kind of makes me sad that he's not in it anymore. As coverage went, I thought they had a lot of cameras, which was good. I thought they did a really good job of following the action throughout the field and not just focusing on the leaders the whole time. And I liked the, like you said, with having Rutledge doing his pieces that are kind of away from the norm is always cool. I thought it was really neat that when they did the driver intros and they got done with driver intros, they immediately interviewed the front row guys. Nice. And I thought that was an angle that we don't normally get at these kind of races, where somebody isn't in the car yet and you're getting their opinion. You know, not like the grid walk type thing, but actually at that moment where they're getting ready to walk to their car and get in, rather than just the milling around during the pre-race stuff. This was, you were at that point where guys were starting to get into race mindset and you got a chance to interview them. I thought that was, the timing of that I thought was really cool. And I also liked the way they did it. I don't know if it was NBC's idea or Indy's idea with the driver intros, where they had all the drivers come out from the back to the front and stand on that podium there at start finish line. Just, I really liked the photo op of it, that you had all 33 guys in the, for lack of a better word, the team photo that they do every year. That gave the fans a chance to get that shot, and I thought that was a really well-done driver intro.
For sure. I would say, I think you'd probably agree, we were spoiled this weekend in terms of racing. Great racing throughout, like we just talked about, the three races, whether it was Indy or the two Charlotte races. But Neff, between the 600 and the 500, which one do you think was the better race this year?
Wow.
That was the toughie I was talking about.
I think I would go with the 600.
I would too.
I think just from the perspective of Pagenaud was so dominant in the 500 that, I mean, there was intrigue. There was definitely entertainment. But you kind of felt most of that race that it was Pagenaud unless something funky happened. And at the 600, you didn't know. I mean, all up to the last restart, I don't think. I mean, yes, Truex had been dominant up to that point, but because of the fact that he wasn't on the front row, I thought that anybody could still get that thing. And I really thought when Busch made the move on a backstretch to the middle that was going to be the move, and he just kind of stalled out. And then lo and behold, Truex gets a push on the bottom and makes that move to the front. That was the crowd went ballistic at that moment. I mean, it wasn't a Dale Jr. roar, but it was close. Back in the day, you could always tell when Jr. took the lead because the crowd was louder than anything else. And that moment on Sunday night was pretty close. That crowd was about as loud as I've ever heard it at Charlotte.
Yeah, and I found some. I agree with you on the 600 being a bit better. But when, you know, I found some irony in that the winner of both races, Truex and Pagenaud, both led 116 laps. That's just a coincidence. But because Truex really had to work for it, having, you know, hitting the wall earlier, never went a lap down. But as soon as I mean, he had to overcome a lot of obstacles, as we mentioned earlier, to get the win. But yeah, very good weekend of racing. Truex has led 872 laps in the past five Coke 600s, which, to put that in essence, you know, into perspective, that's over two full races. So that's over 1,200 miles. And obviously,
but yeah, but he did lead almost all of them in one race.
He led 392 of them in one race, which is all but 12 miles, 580 miles. But still, great weekend of racing, Neff. I think we got some momentum going forward into Pocono this weekend and then for IndyCar into Detroit. Any final thoughts before we sign off?
I want to give a quick shout out to Charlotte and NASCAR for the moment of silence.
Oh, yeah.
That was one of the most amazing things I have ever heard. I was working in the Mooresville area on Sunday, so I didn't get to the track until right at that moment. And I literally was walking into the racetrack at the moment that the moment of silence went on. And if you had closed your eyes, you wouldn't have realized anybody was there. I mean, outside of being able to hear some generators running on some RVs, that was the only sound you heard in the whole place. It was truly moving and truly stunning. And I love Memorial Day weekend because of the racing that it provides, but also for that opportunity to remember those who made the ultimate sacrifice. And it's a good problem to have at Charlotte. But I always try to thank service people anytime I see them at the racetrack, which there's always a bunch. But, man, when you're at Charlotte, it is beyond a bunch. And I don't know, I probably shook 250 hands just over the last 100 laps of the race while I was going up and down pit lane, seeing all the service folks who were still there watching the race. And that moment of silence was, I mean, it just truly was chilling to feel the reverence and feel everybody on the same page doing the same thing. It was really special, and I hope that is something that going forward we do it every time at the 600.
Yeah, and we have a voice on this podcast, obviously, where we can give our opinions out, but sometimes, a lot of the time, silence is the most powerful trait. That comes to everyday life, honestly, in my opinion. But in my opinion, no other entity or sport of professional sport does a better job than NASCAR of honoring the military. And that's not to tout NASCAR, but if you look at it, I mean, each car at the cup level had a sergeant's name on it that has fallen over the past however many years. Some of them local to the Charlotte area, some of them local to my area in Central New York. Doesn't matter. Just really cool what they've done. And you know, obviously we honor these guys on, you know, fallen soldiers on Memorial Day weekend every year, but I don't know that I wasn't at the race in Charlotte, but I wish I was because that was very powerful. I got the goosebumps just watching it and then watching it again, Monday morning on the NASCAR Twitter account. Very powerful. And I can only imagine what the atmosphere was like in that moment.
Yeah, it was remarkable. And it's, I agree. NASCAR does a great job of honoring our military and honoring our country. And Charlotte is exceptional at it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many people paid attention or followed the fact that leading up to the 600, part of their pre-race activities, as it were, is they take drivers around to different military installations. And different drivers get to do different things with the military. And it just kind of, it gives the drivers a chance to interact with the military, which is always, you know, the military folks really appreciate that. But it also gives exposure to the NASCAR fans. They get to see those drivers in a different light. But yeah, Charlotte is always second to none with their pre-race stuff. And the amount of opportunities that they give to the military folks during the race weekend. I know they give out a ton of free tickets. They involve a bunch of the military in the pre-race stuff, and they very seriously and respectfully take advantage of the fact that their race is on Memorial Day weekend.
For sure. And as you mentioned earlier, Jeffrey Earnhardt paid tribute to the fallen police officer in Mooresville from a couple weeks ago, which was, honestly, that paint scheme, that wrap of the car was one of the most beautiful race cars I've ever seen. And as we said, Jeffrey had a good run. So let's get to my conversation with Jeffrey Earnhardt. All right, Jeffrey, you started ninth on Saturday at Charlotte, finished third. Take us through your race as a whole.
Yeah, you know, we really weren't that great in practice. So we made a bunch of changes to the car and showed up Saturday morning and, you know, had a decent qualifying run, you know, qualifying night. So I knew we had made some improvements and we're heading in the right direction at least, but wasn't quite sure of what the outcome was going to be. And, you know, we started the race off pretty free and, you know, knew that, you know, we had to some work on our hands to get that thing dialed in to be able to put together a really good run. And came down pit road, got busted for speeding, and then I just felt like I was making it worse on ourselves. But we ended up getting the car dialed in a little bit better, came back to the field, actually had the car run pretty decent, and I think it was in the final stage there, ended up, you know, getting in the fence a little bit and cutting right rear tire down. That put us a lap down, having to come in and change that and get all the damage repaired. And then I thought maybe our hopes of having a good finish might have been done. And man, the guys, they just didn't quit, and you know, neither did I. So went back out there, fought our way back to the lucky dog spot, got our lap back, and came back to the field again, and came away with a third place finish. If you'd told me on Thursday that we were going to finish third, I'd have told you were crazy just by, you know, how our car was in practice. But it just shows that, you know, these guys, they don't quit and they work their tail off to just, you know, make it a successful program. And they know what they're doing. They know how to do it. They know, you know, how to make the car, you know, drivable to my liking. So it was amazing to have that happen. It was amazing to have that great of a run with Officer Sheldon on our car. Obviously, that was probably the most meaningful part of the whole weekend to me, was getting the opportunity to have Officer Sheldon on our car, and you know, him being a canine officer that had gotten his dog from I-Canine. That was all really, really special. And in honor and tribute to him, we didn't have much choice other than to put together a good run. So it turned out really awesome. It was really cool.
For sure. Now, you hit on a lot there, and I want to talk about getting in the wall late in the race, because I think it happened with just over 50 laps to go. So that's not a lot of time to rebound to get up to third. So how were you able to do that?
Yeah, you know, I definitely didn't help my case for the heat and the way the race was going, for sure. You know, you knocked the fence down, knocked crush panels out of it, and cut a right rear tire down. I mean, it was a lot. You know, it wasn't just a little scuff, I guess. It was, you know, pretty good damage. And man, you know, it just goes back to that whole no quit effort. And you know, having Officer Sheldon on the car, I knew the last thing I could do was lay down on the job there. And, you know, I wanted to make sure that he was upstairs smiling down on us, you know. So, you know, the guys, they busted their butts to get the car, you know, back. Heck, I felt like it was better than it was before I hit the fence, you know, at the end there. So, you know, they made sure to get it dialed in as best they could. And it showed, you know, for us to come back to the field, get our lap back and then come back to the field again and come all the way back up to third. It was pretty awesome. I've gotten a lot of people, you know, telling me how cool it was just to see us coming to the field like that. And, man, it just comes back to good people, or having good people around you and good equipment, man. It makes a world of difference when it comes to situations like that, and knowing that you have what it takes to come back to the field.
Now, you briefly brought up the heat, and I know it was pretty hot in Charlotte. So how challenging was the race from inside the cockpit with the temperature being so warm?
It was tough, you know. That was probably the hottest race I've ever heard of running. And, I mean, on top of that, knocking crush panels out of the car makes it 10 times hotter. So, Yeah, as if it wasn't hot enough, I had to go and make it a little bit worse. But it it was challenging, and you know, just being able to keep your composure and not, you know, get frustrated when you have mishaps or, you know, speed on pit road or stuff it in the fence. You know, it's easy to get frustrated when it's that hot and just miserable in the race car. So, you know, a lot of it was just, you know, a lot of mental toughness, I guess you could say, is and keeping your mind level-headed and not getting spun out.
What did you do, and how did you prepare to hydrate for it?
I drank lots of Pedialyte. Pedialyte's my best friend. I've always drank a ton of Pedialyte, and it seems to do well. You know, drink several bottles throughout the whole weekend, and just trying to, you know, keep your body replenished and hydrate as much as you can. You know, we knew it was going to be a hot one. I mean, it was hot on Thursday, and knew it was going to be hot on Saturday. So you immediately just start hydrating as much as you can, you know, from Thursday all the way through, and try to prepare yourself the best you can. You know, after the race, I mean, I was done. Well, you know, ended up going to the info care center, didn't get IV or anything, just went just to get checked out, and just hot, you know, just felt like my body was overheating. And, you know, that's not something that's easy to train for. I don't know how you really train for 144 degrees sitting in a race car for 4 hours. You know, I don't know what the exact training method for that is, but if someone finds it, let me know, because I'm sure we'll have some more of those days in the future.
For sure. Now, Jeffrey, that was your best finish in NASCAR, third place finish. Take us through that. Like, how proud of you, and how would you gauge the season as a whole so far with three top tens and five Xfinity races?
I would say it's been a really good year. You know, we still want to get wins. And that's mm-hmm. my goal, is to win races. And I know we're capable of it. We just got to get all the pieces to fall in place. And, you know, we're right there. We're beating on the door. So hopefully we can carry this momentum on into Pocono. But, you know, it's just comes back to, you know, being with such a great organization and good people. You know, having a great crew chief, Ben Bashore. He's been incredible to work with. It's everything, man. It's the whole package that makes it possible to go and run and be that competitive. So not just me as a driver, it's not just the crew chief, it's not just the spotter, it's everything. So and then you gotta have the sponsors to give you the opportunity to do it, and I can't have done that for me and give me the chance to go and improve, you know, that I can drive and compete with these guys. So it's a whole package, but man, it's been an awesome start to the year, and we got several races left to go. So hopefully we can knock a couple of wins off before it's all over and said and done with.
For sure. And obviously, you know, you're expected to run well with a top team, but I'm curious, what are some of the challenges coming to a big team? Whether that's something as simple as, you know, not spinning the tires on the restart, which is something you and I've talked about in the past, or, you know, just having better cars, better engines, different gear ratios than maybe running in the back. What are some of the challenges?
No, I would say the biggest thing is just, you know, that transition. You're not racing for a survival finish and hoping for, you know, 25th place finish on a great day. You know, your goal is to win a race, and that's your mindset now. So instead of going out there and just, you know, playing it smart and taking care of the equipment, you're out there and they want you to race as hard as you can the whole time and put yourself in the right position to be able to win that race. And yeah, that's it's different for sure. And how aggressive you got to be on these restarts. You know, it seems like, you know, that's where, you know, we did make up a lot of ground last weekend in Charlotte is on those restarts and just being aggressive and just knowing that, you know, you got to get by these guys as fast as you can on these restarts, because, you know, once everybody gets strung out, it gets that much harder to pass people. So, you know, just little things like that. And, you know, obviously coming here, there's all kind of notes and data and stuff for you to study and homework, I guess you'd say, to do to prepare yourself for that race weekend. And, you know, it's all different to me, but it's all a nice different. You know, it's an enjoyable thing to do. So, it's been a little bit of a learning curve, but man, it's been a fun one.
Now, we talked to Daytona, and you mentioned you plan on leaning on Christopher and Brandon for a lot of advice. I'm curious, how have they been as teammates 5 races in?
It's been awesome, man. You know, I would say, you know, a lot of our success this past weekend was due to them. You know, we unloaded and we were wrecking loose, and, you know, Christopher was pretty damn good, and Brandon was pretty good too. So, you know, we ended up, you know, transitioning more towards, you know, kind of where they were set up, and, you know, it obviously made our car better. So, you know, I talked to them about, you know, kind of what they were doing, what lines they were running and stuff. And, you know, I was trying to commit to the bottom all weekend. And Christopher was like, man, it's a lot faster when you move up and run the PJ1. And we did, and we picked up half a second. So just stuff like that, that really helps, you know, having teammates there to bounce ideas off of. And see what they're doing and pick their brain. And you know, it pays off in the long run. It makes us better as a team, you know, when you got, you know, multiple guys to bounce ideas off of and tell them what they're doing and see what they tried and what worked, what didn't work. You know, it makes our whole program just that much more successful.
Right. Now, we've talked about this a few times, about getting on the Toyota simulator, because you didn't get a lot of that at Chevrolet, and that's one of the things that attracted you to Toyota. How crucial has that been for you in kind of knowing what to expect when you get to the track, not being there every week, obviously?
It's very crucial. You know, we spent a lot of time on it, and, you know, that's something I can't ever thank Toyota enough for giving me, is the opportunity to better myself as a driver and learn and shorten that learning curve. You know, the simulator is just a tool or a crutch to help you and better yourself before you get to the racetrack. So it's been freaking amazing getting the opportunity to get in there and work with Ben and figure out, you know, how to make our cars better. And you know, the thing is so realistic. It's pretty incredible. So it's been a big blessing and helping us and making our program, or me as a program, better. So it's definitely been a good tool for us to use.
Now, Jeffrey, we're heading to Pocono this weekend, as you mentioned earlier. What are your expectations for the old Tricky Triangle?
Well, I want to capitalize on the momentum we have right now and carry that on into the weekend and hopefully, you know, better our finishing results, you know. All my buddies kept saying, man, P3, and I'm like, man, I'm tired of hearing P3, I want to hear P1. So, you know, hopefully we just carry that momentum on into Pocono, and, you know, it's a track that I've ran a couple of times at in a cup car. Never ran there in an Xfinity car, but I really enjoyed it. You know, I really enjoyed going there, and it's a lot of fun. It's different, you know, and you know, I tend to like, you know, tracks that are different. So, I think we'll be good. I think we'll have the momentum behind us and a lot of good notes. Obviously, they've ran real well there in the past. All the Gibbs cars have. So, you know, if we can go there and we can make all the stars line up, who knows? We might be sitting in victory lane at the end of the day.
Got two more for you, Jeffrey, and like you said, Joe Gibbs Racing's always been good at Pocono. The 18 won the race there last year with Kyle. And obviously, if you look at the Xfinity Series over the past decade or so, the 18 car specifically has been kind of the staple. It's been the standard barrier in the Xfinity Series. For you, does that put any more pressure on you, knowing that you're in that car? Or is it just kind of learning and adapting?
Yeah, I mean, a little bit. So when you put Kyle in anything, I feel like he's probably going to win. But, I mean, yeah, Ryan Preece won it as well. So there's a lot of guys that have came and gotten an 18 and won. You know, it just shows that, yeah, that's their bread and butter, and typically that's a fast race car. I mean, but then again, you got Christopher Bell, who just can put a spanking on them at any given day. So you know, it's honestly just the strengths of Joe Gibbs Racing as a whole. And yeah, as you said, you know, 18 won there last last year. I think Kyle Benjamin was really, really fast there. I mean, he was a young guy, you know, in the Xfinity Series that led, I think they said it led like the first 30 laps at Pocono the year before that. So, you know, it's nice to know that, you know, going there, they've had really good strengths there and shown some dominance. So hopefully we can just keep that momentum going and who knows, like I said, who knows, we're going to be fighting for a win, that's for sure. You know, we're tired of flirting with it. We want to get it.
That's what I kind of want to end with. You mentioned to me at Daytona and on this podcast just now that we're going to win races. You're tired of, you know, finishing close, but you want to win. So how close do you feel like you and the 18 team are?
I feel like we're real close. You know, I mean, we've been there on multiple occasions this year. You know, Atlanta, we had a really fast car all day long. And, you know, Charlotte obviously coming on that strong at the end just showed a lot of strengths. You know, that two car was really fast. I don't know that we had a better car than him. He was on rails, but you know, we have been showing some really good strengths, and obviously, you know, the program's been really sporty this year. Christopher Bell's won a couple of races. Brandon's been really, really fast, knocking on the door as well. So it's there. It's just like I said, a matter of all the pieces of the puzzle falling together. And when they do, it's gonna be pretty awesome.
Well, cool, man. Thanks for joining the show. Good luck this weekend in Pocono, and I'll see you there.
Yes, sir. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, y'all. That wraps up this week's show. Fun conversation with Neff, as always, getting to talk to him, especially about the Coca-Cola 600, which is so special to the sport, him and I. But also, Jeffrey Earnhardt brought it, man. He's got a great personality, races hard. And after catching a lot of flack the past couple of years for racing with smaller teams, he's out to prove people wrong this year. And personally, I think he's doing just that, which is pretty cool to see. But before we sign off, we forgot to make predictions, as we always do on the show. Neff told me that he's going with Christopher Bell to win the Xfinity Series race this weekend at Pocono, while also picking Ryan Blaney to win the Cup race. And then for me, I'm on the Tyler Reddick bandwagon right now. The number two car's got 8 straight top fives, as we alluded to earlier in the show, and started inside the top 5 8 straight times as well. But as for Cup, I'm going out on a limb here with Martin Truex Jr. He won this race last year. He also won it in 2015. I say he goes back-to-back this year, this weekend. That wraps up this week's podcast. Until next week's show, where we review that race weekend at Pocono and talk about the 2020 Hall of Fame class, which we totally forgot to do this week, we out.